Hi, this is Susie with In His Shoes Ministries welcoming you to our 12th year of broadcasting, The Next Step with Father Vazquez. Since 2008, we have been producing these podcasts on a weekly basis for those who are seeking practical and deeper applications of their faith and spirituality in their lives today. Blending the most ancient traditions of Armenian Orthodoxy with the challenges of the 21st century, Father Vazquez brings a distinctive and unique voice to the Christian conversation of peace, harmony, and love. Armadoxy is a practical approach to melding spirit and passion in the real world. So turn up the volume and get ready to take the next step.
Well, well, well. Welcome back to The Next Step. I always want to take the next step, don't I? I started off this podcast 12 years ago saying, we're going to take the next step. And then when we do take it, it's kind of scary. It's scary out there. And probably I've never been as scared as I am right now. And I'm not talking about the church. I'm talking about where our world is going. I don't know how many of you out there outside of the United States are following U.S. politics. And I'll say that in this sense, that we hear a lot of times in other countries about coups and about takeovers, about changes in governments, and we look at it as observers, never, of course, firsthand sitting in there and doing it. And throughout my years as a student, later on as a priest in the Armenian Church, I've always advocated opportunities for change, that the status quo cannot exist the way it is because, well, you look around you. It's pretty tragic. And I'm not the one that's going to say the sky is falling. I'm not a pessimist. I love life. I think it's beautiful and all around us, but there are truly some tragic issues that are taking place, especially in terms of the way we deal with one another. And I've spoken to you about it. It's nothing that I just woke up today and said, let's start talking about it. But ultimately, as Christians, we look for that peace, right? That peace and that harmony that has to exist in this world. And we've had opportunities from the secular world too, especially when it comes to music, when it comes to the arts, the liberal arts. You see that there's opportunities there where people want to find means by which we can convey this basic idea that we have to work towards a peaceful and harmonious life in this world. And when events such as what happened here in the United States take place, and in particular I'm talking about the impeachment trial, and probably more than that is the aftermath of the impeachment, I have to wonder, first of all, what is the outside world thinking? Most probably, like I do about other countries, about other, when I'm the outsider looking into other governments, and you see that things are happening, you look at it and you realize at some point that they have to sort it out, that you can't, you know, you're not there. And you can have your opinion about it, but you're not there to do something about it. But in this case, this is right in my backyard. This is right in the United States of America, where we impeached the president. The Congress found, the House of Representatives gave two articles of impeachment. And the trial took place over the last couple days, few days. And yesterday there was a verdict given of not guilty, which is fine. You know, it's there's two verdicts, right? Guilty or not guilty. And you got to live with it, right? But here's what I'm talking about the aftermath, about the shove it in your face attitude, about like, hey, now look what I could get away with. And it is scary. It is scary. I mean, you know, we hear about these kind of scenarios in science fiction, in sci-fi. What was that show a couple of years ago came out? Elizabeth Moss. Handmaid's Tale. Handmaid's Tale. I don't know if you've watched it. It's pretty bizarre. And the question comes up as it unfolds and you realize you're living in a futuristic American state when democracy has crumbled and basically some fundamentalists have taken over. And you say, could that happen? They say, impossible, impossible. We have checks and balances in our system. The Constitution puts checks and balances in our system so that things like that cannot happen. And we had a chance to use our checks and balances over the last few months here in this country. And the president was acquitted. And again, you know, it's up to you how you decide on it. But the aftermath of it, it's ridiculous. It's showing the world, hey, look at me. I got away with some stuff. I'm going to get away with even more. I am stronger than ever. We are stronger every day, right? Yeah. And that arrogance. You start wondering, well, could it happen? Yeah, it could happen. It could happen. Let me see. Margaret Atwood wrote it in Handmaid's Tale. It was fascinating because you start wondering, is it possible? And then when you put it side by side to reality, you say, yeah, it is possible. And again, I'm not sitting here saying the sky is falling, watch out. But what I am saying is that we are being given a set of circumstances that now have become reality. It's no longer sci-fi. And it's bizarre. It's bizarre. I don't know where we're going. I really, really do not know where we're going. And this is the nature of politics, what happened here in the United States. But here's what hurts even more, and this is where we come into the next step. That I've shared with you that why are we using these models? If we are a church, why are we not doing what the church demands us to do? What Christ demands us to do. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and give unto God what is God's. Why are we still playing that political game? And by this, what I mean is if you look in many of the churches, they're siding up with politicians. And I'm not just talking about conservatives. I'm not just talking about in the South. I'm talking about in Orthodoxy. Because, see, we have another element in Armenian Orthodoxy, Russian Orthodoxy, Greek Orthodoxy, Romanian Orthodoxy, Bulgarian Orthodoxy, and that's basically called ethnicity. And that trumps, no pun intended, that trumps the religion. Yeah, it does. We have Armenian church. I'll speak just on behalf of the church that I'm in. We have Armenian churches that will celebrate particular candidates who perhaps have no knowledge. I'm not even going to go the part in saying that they're not Christian, but their belief system and what they advocate and what they talk about has nothing to do with what we as a church should be talking about. But enough, suffice it to say that they are Armenian. We do not even check their credentials of what do they believe in. Now, you know, this is a big issue in the Roman Catholic Church, where they have come out straight out against abortion, right? They have it. It's policy. It's the teaching of the church. I know you're going to say, well, so do we. Yeah, so do the Orthodoxes. But it is pronounced. I'm not even going to say more pronounced. It is pronounced in Catholicism. So they have a big issue because, you know, now you've got bishops, you've got priests who are refusing to give the Holy Sacrament, the Holy Communion, to politicians who advocate for abortion. We in the Armenian Church celebrate politicians. And just recently, we just did one. They just had this giant gathering for some politician from the Reagan era. Yeah. And people came out to the church. I went to church tonight. What did I go for? Well, no. There's no Christ there. No. This is not a judgmental call. There's no Christ there. You know what? The priest getting up and saying a prayer is not why you have come to church. Let's admit it. You have come for the politician to applaud what the politician has done. And we celebrate. Why? What are the credentials of that politician? He or she is Armenian, ethnic definition. And the same is true in the Greeks. I know it. The same is true in the Russians. Not so much, because you don't want to say you're Russian when you're into politics. But the same is true in the ethnic churches, because this ethnicity is the trump card over religion. And what we're doing is we've lost sight of what we are about as a church. It hurts me that we get out there and we celebrate this politician, who he is, who she is, what she's saying, what he's about. Clearly in violation of many of the tenets of Christianity, but even forget about that. You don't need to do a background check. By virtue of the being itself, the beast itself, you know that it's going to, when push comes to shove, that beast is not going to be able to satisfy the tenets of belief, which is fine. Don't get me wrong. All I'm saying is that as a church, what are we doing out there and saying that, hey, congratulations, this is great, come and get a picture taken? It hurts me. Look, this past week we had the impeachment of our president. He was impeached, and by the Constitution, it has to be voted upon. It has to be judged by the Senate of the United States. So the articles of impeachment were brought to the Senate. The Senate voted on it, and they voted down party lines. In other words, Democrats said guilty, and Republicans said not guilty. Straight down politics, straight down the line, which tells you that, okay, yeah, it's a political issue, and, you know, we're not talking about justice, we're talking about where we're at. Yeah, no, you can't argue that. This is not about justice, except for the fact that one of the senators broke with party ranks. Yeah. And this is interesting, because I didn't realize that this was the case, that never, and there has been 3 impeachment trials in the history of the United States, but never has there been a case where the party of the defendant, namely the president, has broken from the ranks and voted against the defendant. In this case, in one of the articles of impeachment, Senator Mitt Romney, who is a Mormon, said that, no, I'm not going to vote with the Republican Party. I'm going to vote because I've been called to ask to judge this, and I'm going to vote the way I see it. Let me read for you what he said. This is in a statement that he made. Says, in the last several weeks, I've received numerous calls and texts. Many demanded, in their words, that I stand with the team. I can assure you that the thought has been very much on my mind. You see, I support a great deal of what the president has done. I had voted with him 80% of the time. But my promise before God to apply impartial judgment required that I put my personal feelings and political biases aside. Were I to ignore the evidence that has been presented and disregard what I believe my oath and the constitutional demands of me for the sake of a partisan end, it would, I fear, expose my character to history's rebuke and the censure of my own conscience. Listen to me, okay? I'm just quoting this, and you're not going to find me quoting too many Mormons, but I find this fascinating. That here's a man who wanted to vote his conscience. I'm aware that there are people, he continues, in my party and in my state who will strenuously disapprove of my decision, and in some quarters I will be vehemently denounced. I'm sure to hear abuse from the president and his supporters. Does anyone seriously believe that I would consent to these consequences other than from an inescapable conviction that my oath before God demanded it to me? Well, he certainly did hear it from the president and from others. But you've got to take note of this. And you have to applaud it. This is very brave. It's very brave what he did. And it's commendable. Our world is going through a lot. There's a lot of populism. There's a lot about ethnicity. There's a lot about my boundaries, my walls. Yeah. We talked a little bit about America. Look at what's going on in Europe. The Brexit. What's Brexit all about? Well, you know, think about it for a moment. You had an opportunity to work as a European Union, but no, we're going to exit that union. Listen to what the president said in the United States at his State of the Union. It was all about it's us against them. Look at what's going on in the Middle East. The division, the divisiveness, and this is getting scary. And what's happening in Asia with the, not only with, yeah, right now we're hearing about this scare, this coronavirus, but what's adding to it is what the coronavirus means to world markets. Because of the coronavirus, world markets are being affected because China over there is such a big player in that world stage. Something happens to China, it means less people going there, less money in their economy, it means more people, and not only going there, but also the export. The Chinese who are going, just this morning, there was a report that in Korea, South Korea, that merchants are reporting up to a 50% loss over last year. Why? Because the Chinese are not venturing out of China to go and do trade in Korea. This was just this morning. And this is nothing new. We've known about this, right? We know we are interrelated, interdependent on one another. This is nothing new. I don't know where this nationalism comes from. We were working towards the globalization movement, and we realize we are all dependent on each other. And when I say nothing new, I mean think about it. Let me pull this up. 1967. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, in one of his speeches, he makes this point. This is actually out of his Christmas speech. It's not that I'm that fast in pulling it up. I was referring to it the other day, but check this out. It says, it boils down to this, that all life is interrelated. We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied with a single garment of destiny. He just had a beautiful way of words, right? Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. We are all made to live together because of the interrelated structure of reality. Let me repeat that and listen really carefully. We are made to live together because of the interrelated structure of reality. Did you ever stop to think that you can't leave for your job in the morning without being dependent on most, not some, on most of the world? You get up in the morning and go to the bathroom and reach over for the sponge, and that's handed to you by a Pacific Islander. You reach for a bar of soap, and that's given to you at the hands of a Frenchman. And then you go into the kitchen to drink your coffee for the morning, and that's poured into your cup by a South American. And maybe you want tea that's poured into your cup by a Chinese. Or maybe you're desirous of having cocoa for breakfast, and that's poured into your cup by a West African. And then you reach over for your toast, and that's given to you at the hands of an English-speaking farmer, not to mention the baker, and before you finish eating breakfast in the morning, you've depended on more than half of the world. This is the way our universe is structured. This is its interrelated quality, and we aren't going to have peace on Earth until we recognize this basic fact of the interrelated structure of all reality. Wow! Like I said, it's nothing new. But we're talking now about nationalism. We're talking about forgetting about what the goal of all of our life should be, namely peace and harmony. And that criticism that I had about the ethnic church is so true, because it's only done on ethnic lines. Have those same churches that dare to call themselves churches belong to Jesus Christ, would they dare to get up and applaud the work of a Christian without a relationship to the Armenian people, to the Greek people, to the Bulgarian people, whatever their ethnicity may be? Yeah, they would, but they've been confounded. People wouldn't show up. Now becomes a practical issue. How do you sell tickets? Yesterday's news had a story, interesting science item. I know many of you outside, I think outside of the United States, nobody uses Fahrenheit. Here in the United States, we use Fahrenheit to, not Celsius, not Kelvin either. I never understood who would use Kelvin. But anyway, we use Fahrenheit, and the average body temperature is 98.6. That's the average body temperature. And there's an article yesterday that the average temperature has now dropped, has decreased. The average temperature now is 97.5. And they attribute this to evolution. We have evolved. Who we are. Read the article. I'll put a link on today's show notes. You'll see about that. My talk is not about how we have evolved, but that we do evolve. And that's a normal process. This is unescapable. And there you have some proof, too, that our temperature has dropped, too, because we take drugs, because not only illicit drugs, but also just some very basic things like aspirin and ibuprofen. And what we are, how we live, the lifestyles, we have dropped. The average temperature of a human being has dropped to 97.5. Look at that, evolution. But where are we as people? Are we evolving or devolving? And that's the basic question we need to ask. And once asked, you have to opt for evolution, because there's no turning back. Evolving as a species, where harmony and peace is your goal, your motive and your goal. We take a break every week for a song, and I think this is a really good time. At least I need a break, and you probably do too. Here's today's song of the day. Thank you. Michael Gulesian. I don't think I've ever played Michael Gulesian on The Next Step 12 years, but I sure do listen to him. That is off of his Unspoken Intentions album, song called Ian and Nisa. Hope you enjoyed it. I love it. It was just a little small little getaway for us. Like I told you, we got some like heavy duties in between, coming up on both sides. This is like a little getaway. And always, it's just a pleasure listening to him. It just kind of lets you get away. Put a link on today's show notes. Do check out not only this song, but all of the wonderful music put out by this very, very talented entertainer, Michael Gulesian. I don't know if you had a chance to watch our new production called WD-168. We are having so much fun producing that, and I would love to hear from you. My Next Steppers, I would love to hear what you think about it. But last week we had a chance to talk a little bit about the Super Bowl and that particular day of the Super Bowl, which happened to be February 2nd, a palindrome by palindrome in its expression in numbers. In other words, February 2nd, 2020 is 02022020, a palindrome because it is read the same way forward and backward. It also happened to be February 2nd, which is Groundhog Day. And Groundhog Day means that it is midwinter. It also means that they have usurped the celebration from the church, which is traditionally Candlemas, namely 40 days after Christmas. And it's an important day because scripturally it is mentioned and referred to that on the 40th day after Jesus' birth, Mary and Joseph took Jesus to the temple for the rite of purification, for the presentation. And we use these two words because, first of all, presentation, according to the law, you would give your firstborn, especially male, to the altar. Purification, in those times, there was the rite of purification for the woman after childbirth, 40 days after they would go into the temple. So there is this custom that is referred to in Scripture, namely in Luke chapter 2. You read about it. Simeon praises the Lord for allowing him to live long enough to see Jesus enter into that temple 40 days after. That is Candlemas, the presentation. Now, we in the Armenian Church, of course, celebrate that same event, but not on February 2nd. And it's very easy. Very easy why we don't do that. Well, February 2nd is 40 days after December 25th. It is definitely the presentation for people who celebrate Christmas on December 25th. And if you are a people, like the Armenians, who celebrate Christmas on its original date of January 6th, then you count off 40 days and you get to February 14th. And then you say, oh no, wait a minute, that's St. Valentine's Day. Yeah, St. Valentine's Day, definitely. And St. Valentine is a saint of the church. Yes, the Orthodox do believe in St. Valentine as a saint as well, recognize him as a saint. Why? Because he's a 3rd century pre-Chalcedon saint. So, okay, so we recognize him. You don't hear much about him because, of course, we celebrate Diarantarach, or the presentation, on February 14th. So we had a chance to talk about this because it again fell on that same day. And it was also Super Bowl here in the United States. What we call football is not the same as what the rest of the world calls football. It's not soccer. We have a big game that there's tons of money involved in, and that's called a football game, and that has a special playoff, namely the Super Bowl. It's the Bowl of Bowls. Bowls refer to the place where they're played, and this is the ultimate of the bowls. And there are millions, if not billions, of dollars being exchanged during this small little, brief little game. Brief when I say about 3-4 hours. from beginning to end. Now, here's the interesting thing. I was doing the calculations the other day. Do you realize it's $5.6 million to buy a commercial on that Super Bowl game for every half a minute? 30 seconds goes by, it's $5.6 million. Break it down into seconds and you've got $186,000 per second. 186, does that sound familiar? Speed of light goes at that speed, doesn't it? 186 miles an a second. Yeah. Speed of light. And you've got $186,000 every second to buy a commercial in the Super Bowl. So you've got to wonder, how do they figure this out? Now, you are a businessman, and you want to get your product out there, right? So you've got to figure it out. I've got like a product, say like, well, let's take one of the products that was advertised on the Super Bowl. They advertised beer. They advertised drinking sodas. They advertised big items too, namely cars, expensive cars. So you could figure those out pretty easily, you know, like if a car costs, you know, $50,000, okay, you need 100 of them to make your half a million, okay. Can you sell 100 of them? Okay, you could do that kind of math easy. But how about like a Dorito chip or a Cheetos, where the item itself is basically pennies, because you're selling like a bag for $2 or $3. Now, how many bags, how many chips itself do you have to sell to recoup $5.5 million after 30 seconds, let alone on top of it to make a profit? This is something that these businesses have figured out. And what's interesting to me when I think about 5.6 million, I'm thinking about here a diocese such as our size, which is fairly large and fairly robust. If you put all the church's budgets, all the parish budgets together, you don't reach even close to 5.5 million. Yeah. Yeah, think about it for a moment. And these executives are thinking about spending 5.5 million to promote their product. And after thinking about it, they realize it's the only way to go. Spend it. We, on the other hand, sit in our meetings in churches and we debate whether we should spend it or not. We debate whether what God has given us, entrusted to us, for us to be the stewards of, whether we should be stewards or we should be just conservative folks who just take it and store it in our pockets, much like the man with the talents who was condemned by Jesus for not using the talents that were given to him. And in a sense, you realize that all of these secular products, whether they are alcoholic drinks, whether they're beer, wine, soda, whether they are cars, or whether you're something as small as a potato chip, these people have taken the road that Jesus has told them. If you have something, go ahead and exploit it. That is your talent. Go ahead and share it with the world. And they're doing it to make these profits, to bring in people. Bring in people means making profits. Okay, so we've got churches that have definitely some big, big issues. Namely, there's nobody coming in. Oh yeah, you know I'm not making that up, right? You know that when you go into a church and you see like 20, 30 people, you realize that I'm not criticizing those 20, 30 people. If you see 100 people, if you see 200, I'm not criticizing that. I remember in Glendale, you know, we used to fill every Sunday. We'd have like 200-300 people in church and people, oh, wow, that's wonderful. No, it isn't. Not in a place like Glendale. You should be at 200,000 every Sunday. The population of the Armenian community here is, at the time, was between 250,000 to 500,000. So 200 people, you know, it's basically the same relative ratio. Yeah, I could take the credit. Yeah, you're right. I could sit there and say, oh, yeah, we were doing a great job. But in reality, that's the reality. These were the people that were coming. So you start thinking about these numbers and you start thinking about, well, what is your responsibility as a steward? And one of the key things is the ability to spend that money. If you look at the story, the parable of the dishonest steward, what did he do? He took the means, the unrighteous man, he took the means that he had and he exploited it to get his gains. And Jesus makes the point, if you're successful with that, don't you think that you could even do even more for the kingdom and the glory of God? Well, think about it. We are stewards in the church, and what are we doing? What are we offering? What are we giving? We're scared. We're scared to spend it. Why? Well, because it comes hard. It's not easy to write a check for a large amount, knowing that, you know, there's an uncertainty. And this is where churches need to really get on the bandwagon of saying that we can no longer rely on picnics and parties to meet our budget. We need to have people who solidly believe and believe in the mission and are willing to cut a check. Look, I'll give you this example. This is in 1998, 99. It was maybe about a year after I had gotten to St. Gregory, Pasadena. And I had come from San Jose, Cupertino area, where relatively we had a small church. We had about 800 family, but a very, very vibrant church in that we knew, all of us knew each other. It was the center of the entire community. It was a wild ride. And we came to Southern California thinking that, okay, here's an opportunity to expand. And that was really basically the draw card. You know, come and we can expand on that ministry. And once we got here, we realized that there were other opportunities, other ways that we could expand rather than the standard ways that we had known. Whereas in San Jose, you are the center. In Southern California, you have many, many opportunities. You're competing, yes, quote unquote, competing against other organizations, other churches. Yeah. So we looked at what are the means, and we said, okay, hey, you know what? There's television. And this is right at the time that the internet was still in its infancy stage. I had been dabbling with the internet since in Cupertino. We had set up the Armenian Information Network. We were using email, but still, as far as websites, these were just coming of age. You know, the dot-com bubble was coming about 2-3 years later. So we're at the end of the 90s. And television was the means by which to get the information out. And we thought about it, and we found a spot on local television that at the time charged us $10,000 for a one-year contract. They would give us a half an hour, and I can't remember if it was Saturday evening or Sunday evening. It was one of the weekend evenings. They gave us a half an hour slot, and we could program it. What we needed to do is we need to get film done, ready, processed, and delivered to the studio for the weekend. Yeah, that was it. $10,000, that would give us 52 weeks. And I was able to talk our parish council, talk to them, explain to them the opportunities, and they were brave enough to say yes. They were brave enough to say yes. And we did it. It was an adventure. Actually, it was the beginning of EPOSL. What today I call EPOSL had its beginnings right there. So you're hearing some of the early years of that. It was in the year 2000 that we formalized EPOSL. In the year 2000, we had a partnership with Japonica Partners. I can't remember, someplace in back east. And they subsidized the Divine Liturgy, the Easter Divine Liturgy, to be broadcast on the internet, the first broadcast electronic. And it was audio only. And if you do a search, I don't know, I will make a note. It's somewhere on the internet. It's been archived somewhere on the internet. But it's basically the Divine Liturgy that we did an audio broadcast. And we coined the name Epostle. Apostolic Evangelism for an Electronic World. That was in the year 2000. But prior to that, we had started these television shows, and we found that they were very popular. So I'd get up and I'd give a little sermon. We had a young lady who'd give the upcoming events. So she would talk about what's going on at the church right now and what events are coming up. So think about it. In 15 minutes, you're getting the priest with a message, and you're getting a young lady telling you the events that are coming. Well, that's 15 minutes. Well, guess what? We have to do it again in English. We did the first part in Armenian. We replicated in English. So we had a half an hour show all of a sudden. Half an hour, and we had to put it together. You know, I wish we had some pictures from those days. We didn't have teleprompters. What we did is we actually, on a dot matrix printer, we would actually print out the script on huge, huge letters. Like, I think like you'd get like three or four words on each page, and we'd put them on rollers. Yeah, it was wild. It was wild. But we did it for a whole year. And you know what? There were people who got it. Because all of a sudden, our school, we ran a day school. The day school was at capacity and running a waiting list. We had churches, we had our church where we had to tear down our church and take our service into the hall. And we had a capacity of 2,000. We would get about 1,000 to 1,500 on an average Sunday. And of course, on the big holidays, we would be at 4,000 or 5,000 people. With, you know, speaker systems outside. And so you see that the number was directly related to our efforts, what we were doing. So that was fantastic. Except some people didn't see it that way. Because people who were coming to church were also buying candles. They were also contributing. They were also making their donations and plate collection. Membership was up. But what they weren't seeing is somebody who came and said, here is a check to take care of the television show. So that television became a goal rather than the means. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, for some people, they thought that the television should have received its own money. Like if we are putting out $10,000, then somebody should pay that $10,000 as a donation to the church. Instead of seeing all the money that's coming in. And you think about I think about this every year at the Super Bowl, because it's exactly that same model. The guy who's selling the potato chip doesn't sit there and say, oh, how am I going to get $5.5 million? Somebody to give me $5.5 million so I could advertise my potato chip. No, it's all worked out. If I do that $5.5 million ad, I will sell $20 million worth of potato chips, from which I will take the $5.5 million and pay for the ad, and I will have a profit of $15 or $14.5 million in my pocket. Ah, simple math, right? More than simple math. It requires us to look beyond and to understand that God has given everything to us for us to manage. And especially in the church, you cannot be scared to manage efficiently. And you know what? You don't need models from Scripture. You need models from reality. That's the point of the dishonest steward. In his own space, the guy knew how to do it. You see, Jesus lays it out just for us to follow the directions. And it's also for us to kind of understand what that next step is. Listen, before I finish today, I want to share with you something, and this has absolutely nothing to do with what I have been talking about. It's just a little treat for you. Because I had a chance to listen to Peter Asher the other day. He's famous from Peter and Gordon back in the 60s. Anyway, he was talking a little bit about the Beatles and his time with the Beatles, with Paul McCartney and John Lennon. And all of a sudden, he went into this small little discussion about Lewis Carroll. Yes, you know Lewis Carroll, Alice, the Looking Glass. And he referred to a poem called The Walrus and the Carpenter. And John Lennon apparently was well-read in Lewis Carroll. He loved Lewis Carroll. And this imagery, when I heard The Walrus and the Carpenter, I said, I want to share that with you. Because, I heard it the first time he recited it, and I said, you know what, I'm going to share that with the next steppers. But then I went into my own little spiral, you know. I went in through the Looking Glass because I started, like, investigating, like, what did Lewis Carroll have to say about this? And listen to this. Lewis Carroll, Victorian author, was born in Dodgson, England, 1832, okay? The son of a clergyman. Carroll was the third child born to a family of 11 children. From a very early age, he entertained himself and his family by performing magic tricks and marionette shows and by writing poetry for his homemade newspaper. In 1946, he entered rugby school, and in 54, did I say 1846? Okay. And in 1854, he graduated from Christ Church College in Oxford. He was successful in his study of mathematics and writing and remained at the college after graduation to teach. His mathematical writings included an elementary treatise on determinatics, Euclid and his modern rivals, and Curiosa Mathematica. Like, pretty wild, huh? All of a sudden, I'm like meeting this, and I don't think it's by chance, because I was so ready for this, especially where I am in my life. So I needed, because I said, the only reason why I'm reading about this is because I heard this Walrus and the Carpenter, and I said, I need to share this with my next steppers. So all of a sudden, I'm starting to read it, and it says, while teaching, Carroll was ordained as a deacon. However, he never preached. He also began to pursue photography, often choosing children as a subject of his portrait. One of his favorite models was a young girl named Alice Liddell, the daughter of the dean at Christ Church, who later became the basis for Carroll's fictional character, Alice. He abandoned both photography and public speaking between 1880 and 1881 and focused on his writing. I'll put a full bio on our show notes. This is according to poets.org. But I'm here for you, because this is what I really wanted to do. I would like to read for you The Walrus and the Carpenter. If you happen to know some of the lyrics in the Beatles, and a little bit beyond, you're going to be surprised, especially when you hear some of the imagery. I definitely thought of you and want to share it with you. The Walrus and the Carpenter, Lewis Carroll. The sun was shining on the sea, shining with all his might. He did his very best to make the billows smooth and bright. And this was odd because it was the middle of the night. The moon was shining sulkily, because she thought the sun had got no business to be there after the day was done. It's very rude of him, she said, to come and spoil the fun. The sea was wet as wet could be. The sands were dry as dry. You could not see a cloud because no cloud was in the sky. No birds were flying overhead. There were no birds to fly. The walrus and the carpenter were walking close at hand. They wept like anything to see such qualities of sand. If this were only cleared away, they said, it would be grand. If seven maids with seven mops swept it for half a year, do you suppose, the walrus said, that they could get it clear. "I doubt it," said the carpenter, and shed a bitter tear. "Oysters, come and walk with us," the walrus did beseech. "A pleasant walk, a pleasant talk along the briny beach. We cannot do with more than four to give a hand to each." The eldest oyster looked at him, and never a word he said. The eldest oyster winked his eye and shook his heavy head, meaning to say he did not choose to leave the oyster bed. But four young oysters hurried up, all eager for the treat. Their coats were brushed, their faces washed, their shoes were clean and neat, and this was odd because, you know, they hadn't any feet. Four other oysters followed them, and yet another four, and thick and fast they came at last, and more and more and more, all hopping through the frothy waves, and scrambled to the shore. The walrus and the carpenter walked on a mile or so, and then they rested on a rock, conveniently low. And all the little oysters stood and waited in a row. "The time has come," the walrus said, "to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings." "But wait a bit," the oysters cried, "before we have our chat, for some of us are out of breath, and all of us are fat." "No hurry," said the carpenter. They thanked him much for that. "A loaf of bread," the walrus said, "is what we chiefly need. Pepper and vinegar, besides, are all good indeed. Now, if you're ready, oyster dear, we can begin to feed." "But not on us," the oysters cried, turning a little blue. "After such kindness, that would be a dismal thing to do." "The night is fine," the walrus said. "Do you admire the view?" "It was so kind of you to come, and you are very nice," the carpenter said nothing but, "cut us another slice. I wish you were not quite so deaf. I've had to ask you twice." "It seems a shame," the walrus said, "to play such a trick after we've brought them out so far and made them trot so quick." The carpenter said nothing but, "the butter's spread too thick." "I weep for you," the walrus said. "I deeply sympathize." With sobs and tears he sorted out those of the largest size, holding his pocket handkerchief before his streaming eyes. "Oysters," said the carpenter, "you've had a pleasant run. Shall we be trotting home again?" But answer came there none. And this was scarcely odd, because they'd eaten every one.
Susie here again. Before continuing with today's broadcast, I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that this podcast is made possible through your prayers and generous donations. Since 2008, we have been providing quality programming through podcasts, educational videos, and streams, using technology's most current resources. The message of Armenian Orthodoxy is giving people an intelligent and practical answer to many of life's difficulties, including the challenge to bring peace to a hurting world. To become part of this dynamic ministry, please take a moment now to visit inhisshoes.org website and press on the donate button. Your encouragement goes a long way. Please accept our heartfelt appreciation. Thanks for listening, and God bless. We now return to this week's Next Step with Father Vazquez.
Thank you, Susie. And I hope you all enjoyed today's show. It was kind of fun, wasn't it? I love that walrus and carpenter. I would love to hear from you. Drop me a line. I'm at feedback@epostle.net. Let's see, in the next few weeks, we are going to be here and there, primarily in Northern California on Sundays. We are at the Oakland St. Vartan Armenian Church for the Divine Liturgy, offering our words and sharing in the sermon, and just some great fellowship. Beautiful, beautiful people up north. And I have a very special affinity to Northern California. It's always a pleasure to be up there. Coming up this next week, I guess next Thursday, a week from today, is Diyarun Tarach. It's the 13th, so it's the night before Diyarun Tarach, the presentation service. I'm going to be at the St. Leon Armenian Cathedral, where I'll be offering the homily that evening, and we have a traditional bonfire taking place. If you are newlywed, planning on getting married, you just want a very beautiful tribal experience. Yeah, very, very tribal. Come down. We are in Burbank at the Mother Cathedral. Coming up, people have been asking me, when is Lent this year? February 24th. We start on the Monday after Pare Genton, which is in the West is known as Mardi Gras or Fat Tuesday. We start our Lent on Monday following Fat Sunday or Pare Genton, the Day of Good Living. So February 24th, we'll have more information coming up in the next few weeks about what to do. I'm looking into some new programming too, and it's getting exciting. Do check out our show notes where I'll put everything down and you'll have links. Finally, I want you to, if you've never been to a Reclaim conference, this might be the year to do it because you have enough time. I'm telling you early enough. It's going to be March 13, 14, and 15 in Burbank. It's Reclaim Etchmiadzin. It's 3 days. Primarily, it's on Saturday where we're going to have talks. We're going to have a spiritual meal, something that, you know, like we've done these every year, and each one of them is just so beautiful. This is our fourth year of doing Reclaim. I hope you will join us. If you happen to be in the Los Angeles area that weekend, please make a point of coming by. If you're not going to be there, make a point of flying out there, driving out there, getting out there. It's something you will not regret. So that's Reclaim 2020, Reclaim Etchmiadzin. Well, that does it for us today. Why don't you check out the show notes? You'll find links and you'll find ways to connect with us. We're on all the socials and love to hear from you at feedback@epostle.net. On behalf of the wonderful crew who put today's show together, Ken, our technical director, and Susie, who's celebrating her birthday. Happy birthday, Susie. This is Father Vosken inviting you to join us again next week when we will take the next step.
And now here's the fine print. The information and comments presented within this podcast and our website do not necessarily represent the views of the Armenian Church hierarchy, but are presented as a challenge to define the dynamics of Armenian Orthodoxy in all aspects of life. Listening to these shows is habit-forming. Addictive behavior associated with the next step is rarely, if ever, remedied. Rather, the next step is known to relieve and cure common cases of narrow-mindedness, prejudice, numbskulledness, and glaucoma in patients over the age of 20. Results may vary depending on credit rating. Findings are based on double-blind studies conducted in Istanbul and Jerusalem. Side effects include mind expansion, clarity of focus, higher rates of heart palpitations, sensitivity to the pain of others, and occasional nausea. The management and production crew of epostle.net take full responsibility for changes you will experience. Not valid with any other offer.
I'm top limit.